When it comes to energy policy in South Africa, there are so many competing voices and vested interests that it's often hard for the public to discern lobbying for one technology over another to benefit specific groups or vendors over genuine concerns around long-term energy policy and planning that lock the taxpayer, you and I, into costly mistakes. When Minister of Mineral Resources and Energy Gwede Mantashe announced the winning emergency power bidders and open bid window 5 of the REAP program, there was a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth over the inclusion of Turkish power ships in particular. Not so much the technology solution for a short-term problem, but as the terms over 20 years and the lack of local content. The Risk Mitigation Independent Power Producer Procurement Program, or the RMI PPP, is a direct response to fill the 2,000 megawatts of short-term electricity supply gap that South Africa's Integrated Resource Plan, the IRP of 2019, indicated between 2019 and 2022. And this risk mitigation program is meant to fill the stated supply gap and reduce the use of expensive diesel-based peaking electrical generators in the medium to long term. Now, the evaluation process resulted in the selection of 8 preferred bids totaling 1,845 megawatts and a further 3 eligible bids totaling 150 megawatts. Those 3 are subject to value for money proposition in line with the provisions in the request for proposal, the RFP. Now, the preferred bidders, just to run through them, are Aqua Power Project, DAP, Car Powership SA Kuka, Car Powership SA Richards Bay, Car Powership SA Saldanha Bay, Mililo Total Kuka, Mililo Total Hydro Storage and Oya Energy Hybrid Facility, and Omoyilanga Energy. Now, to explore the rationale and the outcomes and some of the details of this recently announced emergency power procurement, it's a great pleasure to welcome now the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy's Deputy Director General, Jacob Mbele, Professor Mark Swilling, Distinguished Professor of Sustainable Development at the School of Public Leadership at Stellenbosch University and Deputy Chair of the DBSA, and Stefano Marani, the CEO of Renergen, a junior natural gas and helium company listed here and in Australia. Deputy DG, perhaps it's worth just taking a step back. Just remind us what the Risk Mitigation Independent Power Producer Procurement Program sought to achieve that is separate from the REAP and the IRP.
No, thanks for the question. Let me first start by indicating that it is actually not separate from the IRP. It is the IRP that first identified the supply demand gap that we are likely to face. Hence, there is what we call decision one in the IRP that says that due to the challenges that we have with the Eskom plant performance, we need to urgently undertake procurement of additional power to close the gap. And that also recognized the fact that it takes minimum about 36 months to get a traditional utility scale project online. So decision one was premised along the lines that you need to go and look for possible solutions that can be brought online in the shortest possible time. That decision in the IRP even talks to, it says that lead time is of importance. So first, I thought it's important to clarify that the proposal, it's not outside of the IRP. It is something that was envisaged in the IRP. That's the first part. The second part of it that I want to emphasize is that the IRP had recognized that traditional solutions would take time to come online. Hence, we needed a solution that could urgently assist in closing the gap. And that is why, following the promulgation of the IRP, we issued a request for information in December 2019. Where we basically went out to the market and we said to the people out there to say, we're looking for solutions to help us close the gap. Tell us what you've been working on or what is available. And the feedback that came back indicated two key things was that there are facilities that are currently operational, the likes of, you know, the Sasols, the Mondis that have their own generation, which were actually saying, given an opportunity, we're willing to sell into the grid, but because this is power that we use for ourselves and it's not greenfield, we're willing to even enter into a short-term contract, you know, because then we'll still give you a reasonable price. And then there are people who came back as part of that feedback and indicated that they have been working on projects, and these projects, because they're going to be greenfields, they're going to be capital intensive, can work and can come online as soon as possible, but they will require a long-term arrangement for us to get an affordable price of electricity, which, by the way, the distinction between whether you get into a short-term contract or long-term contract, it's about affordability. You know, whether it's renewables or it's fossil fuel, it's about affordability. We went into the 20-year term even with the renewables in the same premise that if you spread this over a period of time, you allow the price per unit to be as low as possible. And in this regard, then, we designed two interventions. The first intervention was when Eskom went out to the market and said, we're looking for what they call the SDPPP, short-term power purchase program. That's what they ran. And I think they got some 200 megawatts or so that they are finalizing. And the department, in line with the programs that we've ran, we then put together the risk mitigation. And I think it's important, we don't call it emergency program because we were not going out to procure emergency power. We were going out to procure power in the shortest possible period of time. And I think that's the distinction, because the debate seems to suggest we're going for the so-called emergency power, which I'm not sure, you know, if there is that definition, you know, in out there. So basically that's the thinking around the department, and that is how we go to the risk mitigation. Just touching on the program itself, the design of what went into the program was we had extensive discussions with the system operator, who happens to be Eskom, and said, the gap that you are seeing has got a characteristic. Please define what this gap looks like, so that when we go out there, we don't say we want PV, or we want solar, or we want coal, or we want gas, and you come back and you say, but that's not what I'm looking for. Then Eskom gave us a specification. You know, for example, they said, we want power that's dispatchable and flexible. It should be available between 5 a.m. and 9 p.m. It must have a minimum load factor of 50% per annum. And then the program then was designed around that to say, there are experts out there. Here's a specification. Throw solutions at the problem. So we were procuring solutions, not technology, and solutions that best fit the problem that the system operator had indicated that they are facing. Maybe I should stop here.
And on that point, there has been some critique of the RFP potentially in the way that it was drafted that led to these particular outcomes. But hearing what you're saying, Deputy DG, it was at Eskom's behest that you were looking at the specific load factors and capacity utilization. I just, before I want to move around the panel, want to touch on the elephant in the room, or the power ship in the room, is the car power ship. Which is one a big chunk of this bid. The bulk of these were awarded to the car power gas ships. There has been some opposition, not necessarily to the fact that we're using them in the short term, and there's perhaps a difference here between filling the gap in the short term and closing the gap over a period of 20 years. Can you just take me through the rationale of why you decided to award 20-year power purchase agreements and not 5-year power purchase agreements, and send the ships on their way when we've got new capacity coming on stream in year 4 and 5 from the REAP program?
No, thanks for that question, because generally that question is premised on the assumption that when we put out the RFP, we had some indication that the power ships would be bidding and the power ships are going to win. Like I said, when we put out the solution, the request for proposal, it was a request for proposal for people to throw solutions at the problem. But as I also indicated, that when we did the RFI, indications were that people were saying, we've got greenfield solutions that will require long-term, because for us, what's important, it's the unit cost of electricity. I mean, it's like buying a house. You know, the question is, why would you want to buy it over 5 years and you buy it over 20 years? It's about affordability, right? So we could have done a program for 5 years, but I can tell you, if we had done a program for 5 years, even the renewable projects that have come through this program would probably cost 4 or 5 times. You know, so we'll be talking probably in the regions of 4 rand per kilowatt hour. So the reason behind the long-term PPA was to say we understand that these are greenfield projects, and I'm talking before we had done the evaluation. The car powerships or the powerships came out of a process of evaluation. So it's not like we knew when we went into the process that they are going to bid the lowest price or the lower price within the band of everybody else. You know, so I think the difficulty with that question is that it is premised generally on the assumption as if this was a negotiated process upfront. This was a process whereby a request for a proposal was put out, bidders put forward their bids within the parameters of what was specified, and all bids were evaluated based on the criteria that was made publicly available as part of the RFP. You know, so there is no subjectivity that comes in post, you know, you having issued the RFP. Government procurement processes are very clear. You know, you can't, if you want to run a open and transparent process, you can't, when you see something that you think you don't like, suddenly want to change the rules.
Mm. There are, and Jacob will come back to it, there is obviously skepticism and speculation in the market that it has been designed in such a way to create an anchor tenant for the prospect that is being developed by Total, the Brill Putter prospect, because effectively, if you look at what the PPA does, it has all the hallmarks of that. But Professor Swilling, we'll come back to that point. Overall, what do you make of the decision and the rationale to award the bulk of this round to the car powerships?
Well, just to clarify your introduction of me, I'm talking in my academic capacity. You refer to my role on the board of the DBSA. That's not relevant in this conversation. I'm an independent academic, and from that perspective, what we have here is a very cleverly designed set of rules that favours a particular set of players. So you can run a completely transparent, objective process, but if the rules of the game have been set in a certain way to favor some and not other kinds of technologies, then it's pretty clear what the outcome is going to be, and this is what we have. So in my view, the car power ships awards don't make sense on a number of different criteria. The most important is that it hooks us to the international gas prices. So the effective price of gas now, right now, is higher than the bid price was. So gas prices rise and fall, and in general, they're going to rise over time. Mm-hmm. And the cost of that gas is a pass through for the project, but it is not a pass through for Eskom, which who have fixed tariffs, and for the country that has a fixed economic base. So we will be absorbing the price impact of that gas over time. So in the end, it's going to work out more expensive. Secondly, car power ships has never, ever won a contract longer than 10 years. So we have set a world precedent by granting a 10-year PPA for car power ships. The reason why we have got a 20-year period was actually to cater for the renewable sector. So Aqua Power's price per kilowatt hour is lower than the car power ships. So it does prove that renewables can but it doesn't make gas cheap over a long period of time. The other cost that is not taken into account is the leases. So the leases on the ships are not 20 years. So those leases, those ships are made by the same company that is leasing the ships. So they can set the price. And that is also a pass-through for the project, but it's not a pass-through for Eskom and for the country, for SA Inc. So we will be absorbing the increased prices of those leases as they get renewed on those ships. So gas and leases are the two factors. Now, when it comes to renewables, there's a fixed price. You build the infrastructure, and for 20 years, the sun shines, the wind blows, and you know exactly what the costs are going to be, and you can set the price, and it's fixed. And that's where Mr. Mbeli is absolutely correct. Because of the expense of the upfront infrastructure costs, you need a 20-year period. But that's not true for a gas installation of this nature. Other kinds of gas, yes, but not this kind of gas installation, which is a lease base. And then there's the problem of local content, the exemption from local content, and the rationale that's been provided that there is local content for everything else except the ships is really actually quite unbelievable, actually, because it actually ridicules and diminishes the significance of our local content program, which is the driving force, the vanguard of our industrialization program. And to say, oh, okay, local content means everything that you don't import, you must make sure is made locally. Hello? That's not the point. It's to prevent importing a whole bunch of stuff so that you can make locally. That's what the local content is about. There's also low employment during O&M. And there's also the problem with the load factor. Why use gas for base load when actually what you should be doing is using gas to back up intermittent supply through renewables. So those are some of the reasons why in the industry there is a widespread kind of amazement that we are hooking our energy future to a resource that is more expensive than renewables, is less predictable, more unstable, and exempts the supplier from local content provisions, which is the fundamental instrument we have available to us to drive industrialization. And industrialization is the only way we're going to solve our biggest problem, which is unemployment.
Steph, from your vantage point as someone who understands the gas sector, CEO of Renergen, what do you make of the idea and the awarding of the bulk of this RMI PPP to the car power ships? One can clearly understand the arguments against using very expensive diesel to fuel our peaking plant, but what does this mean for onshore gas?
Thank you. So I certainly can't criticize or fault any of Professor Swilling's points that he's made. I think that there's definitely, particularly the long-term nature of the contracts, that's something that personally I would question. As a short-term solution, power barges are an infinitely sensible solution, but again, as a short-term solution. Yeah. And I think that that's the important thing over here. I can understand that, if you enter into a 20-year lease, then you're going to get a cheaper lease per kilowatt hour for the equipment. But planning to import an alternative energy source where the energy source itself has been beneficiated in another country is something that fundamentally I find difficult. And I find this difficult because, the mantra behind the company that I represent is that, we're pioneering the onshore gas space in South Africa. We're the country's only onshore natural gas producer that has a production right. Everything that we produce and that we pump into the economy, every single diesel liter equivalent that we sell to our customers is one less liter of energy that the country as a whole needs to import from someone else. And that means that everything that we do is beneficiated onshore in South Africa, whereas everything that we import, we're essentially paying someone else's profit margins abroad. And so I believe that there is a fantastic opportunity to be able to bring gas projects onshore in South Africa with the right will. And that's the critical part, is having the right will. We looked at some of these tenders, and I mean, just the sheer fact that it was something like 9 volumes, and each volume had seven chapters, and each chapter had 300 pages. We didn't have the manpower to actually submit anything. So I kind of regret the $25,000 that we spent to get the documents in the first place, and we just binned it all. There's no point in doing it. But I do believe that there's a huge opportunity being foregone over here, because onshore gas production is very quick to mobilize with the right skill set and with the right know-how. You know, we could have a power plant up and running in say 12 to 18 months, and that would be domestically produced. It would be rand denominated, linked to CPI, and you'd know in advance exactly what the mm-hmm. pricing would be, because the capex is all spent up front. And you know what the cost of extraction is. So in that regard, I think that there's certainly an argument along what the professor is saying to be made, that we should be using more of our onshore natural resources. And certainly that's what we're advocating. We need to be using more of our onshore resources. The one area where I do see a little bit of a challenge in that going completely renewable, and as much as we're all about renewable energy ourselves and it's about cleaning the economy as much as you can, the one challenge that you do have with potentially putting too much solar on the grid is that if you look at the peak, the load consumption in South Africa, it looks a little bit like the Golden Gate Bridge from the side, with these two peaks, and then the extreme ends are very low, and in the middle it's kind of somewhere in the middle. The problem is that if you put too much solar, the solar all comes on at around midday. That's when it's at its highest. And it produces very little in those two peaks, which is when you need the most power. Now, the problem with our current baseload generation, and I stipulate our current baseload generation, is that the flywheel in your coal-fired power stations only has a range of between 60% and 100%. It can't go below 60% and it can't go above 100%. Below 60%, your power station, you can think of it as quasi-stalling. Now, the challenge that we have is that if you put on too much during that 12 o'clock period, the gap between your very highest peak and your lowest turndown point would exceed the gap between the peak and your nighttime usage. And this causes a problem. The problem that it causes is that you don't have the ability to turn the power station down fast enough. And so inadvertently, I'm not blaming solar for necessarily causing the current load shedding, but it makes the distribution of power and the consumption of power and the generation power much more challenging when you only have the majority of your power coming on at one certain time of the day, which is where gas is a lot more flexible, which is inadvertently, I also think, that something that the professor was saying. Gas is insanely useful because you can turn it on and off at the drop of a hat. It's very flexible and needs to be seen as a flexible tool, and obviously 90% less CO2 emissions than carbon with coal, which is great.
And comes back to battery storage to make it more dispatchable if you're talking about renewable sources. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here. Deputy DG, I want to come back to you on the issue of the gas price and this being indexed through to the international gas price and passed through to the South African consumer. Have you modelled what potentially this 20-year PPA could end up costing the South African government, the taxpayer?
Look, I mean, our view is that the price does not necessarily just go up. It depends. It's a supply and demand case. And if you look back, I mean, you will see that there was a time when, I mean, the price of gas was very low, I mean, in the market. That's the first point I wanted to make, is that it's a function of supply and demand. So it could go up. I think that the current debate is, again, on the basis that the price will just go up, right? If you look at, for example, in the IRP, we had modeled the gas that's in the IRP was actually modeled assuming a gas price of $10. Per gigajoule, or you can say MMBTU per gigajoule, which is generally, you know, delivered, which is generally considered slightly high. So there are models that we've done, but the point I wanted to make as well is that I wouldn't want to necessarily respond to Steph, because I've just picked up that he's one of the bidders or one of the players in the sector, and I'm very careful to engage in a debate around someone who would have played. But the point I want to make is, I want to make two points, is that the IRP has shown that gas is a requirement for system adequacy into the future. There is no debate about it, right? So I think that's the first point I want to make. And even to respond to, I think, the point that was made by Professor Swelling, is that we're not going to transition from where we are to a different situation without relying on gas. You know, we're going to need gas, and because gas provides us with the flexibility, I think that was indicated, that at times you need quick response in the system, and gas provides that. That's the first point I wanted to make. The second point I wanted to make is that the gas that's procured now is a fraction of the gas that you require in the system. I mean, if you look at a second determination, there is still about 3,000 megawatts that we envisage that we want to procure in terms of gas, you know, into the future. So the notion that you've taken all this gas and you've given it to one player is also misplaced, because, as I said, that gas part of the project was as a result of a specification. And here I want to touch to the point that Professor Swelling was making, to say we also need to be careful to prescribe a solution based on our preferences, not necessarily on what the requirements are. And I find the debate around what should have been more about what people think it should have been, not necessarily on the basis of them understanding what the problem is and what we needed to solve the problem. Once again, there's this view that the RFP was structured such that it drives a certain outcome. I can't respond to that. I think maybe then we say the system operator, which is Eskom in this regard, did that deliberately. And having worked with them over a number of years, and having worked for Eskom myself, I doubt that they would do that, because that would not be in the interest of maintaining system integrity. So I can only reduce these views to wanting to discredit the process. The issue of gas pass-through and not pass-through for Eskom, I didn't understand the point exactly that the professor was making, but the point I want to clarify is that as anything that's a pass-through to Eskom, as there are regulatory mechanisms for Eskom to recover that cost. So it does not mean if that's why there's what we call the RCA.
The regulatory clearing account. Mechanism.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, that Eskom, and it applies, by the way, the same for coal. If Eskom had to procure coal at a slightly different price to what they had made an assumption for, there is a mechanism for them to go to the regulator and say, coal in the market was slightly cheaper, was slightly higher. You know, can you adjust accordingly? So the regulatory mechanism allows for a pass-through right through the value chain. The last point I want to make is around this thing that this point around that renewables are, you know, what you get today is what you pay and nothing changes. It's not true. The price of renewables is subject to CPI increase into the future. So it's not a flat price. So there is an increase, you know, there is an increase that is related, you know,
But it's an understood price. But it's an understood price and not a variable price. I mean, you can link something to inflation and have a high degree of certainty versus the international gas market, which has ranged between $8 and $20 over the last 15 years.
But I guess it's a fairly the point that one makes is that I think maybe the different point I must make is that there's also this talk about, yes, we must not only go for gas that is going to come offshore from somewhere else. Our view is that there is gas, there are explorations in the country, there is talk of shale gas, and at the right time, that gas will become available, you know, in whatever form, be it offshore or onshore gas. And I'm sure the project that will come through the gas to power program will also consider that gas. I mean, there is gas in Mozambique, and we believe that obviously the project that will definitely see through the 3,000 megawatts of gas that is still to come would probably utilize the gas. So I think the point I wanted to make is that we mustn't make it look like the 1,200 that is currently in this program, it's the only gas. I mean, there is a lot of gas that's required to support the system going forward.
Deputy DG, I'm going to have to stop you there because we have run out of time. So many questions, though, still to talk about. We're going to have to do a follow-up conversation. That was Department of Mineral Resources and Energy Deputy Director General Jacob Mbele, who is joined by Professor Mark Swilling, a Distinguished Professor of Sustainable Development at the School of Public Leadership at Stellenbosch University, and Stefano Marani, CEO of Renogen, talking about the RFI PPP and many questions that have been raised following the inclusion of 1,200 megawatts and just slightly more in terms of the gas car power ships. Judge for yourself.